56, readers across Western Europe were consuming it and tying African people to hypersexuality, to animals, and to the lack of reason. It is not known what happened to Leo the African, the author of the most widely read and most influential book on Africa, next to Zararas during the 1500s. He made countless Europeans feel that they knew him, or rather, knew Africa. Around the time Leo the African's text was making its way through Europe, and around the time Richard Mather's parents were born, the British began their quest to break the Portuguese monopoly on African slave trading, eager to reap the benefits and grow their empire. In 1554, an expedition captained by John Locke, ancestor of philosopher John Locke, arrived in England after traveling to Guinea. Locke and his compatriots Robert Gaynish and William Towerson docked with 450 pounds of gold, 250 ivory tusks, and 5 enslaved African men. These 3 Englishmen established themselves as the new authorities on Africa and African people among curious British minds. Their opinions seemed to be shaped as much by the Portuguese and French as by their own observations. Sounding like Leo Africanus or Zurara, Gaynish labeled Africans a people of beastly living, without a god, law, religions, or commonwealth. The 5 beasts that he and his shipmates brought back to England all learned English and were sent back to Africa to serve as translators for English traders. As English contact with Africans matured, so did the desire to explain the radical color differences. Writers like Gaynish applied climate theory to the dark skins of Africa and the light skins of Europe. The popular theory made sense when looking at Europe, the Mediterranean, and Africa. But what about the rest of the world? During the final decades of the 16th century, a new genre of British literature adopted the climate theory. Amazing writers brought stories of the world into Anglican homes, into the Puritan homes of Richard Mather and John Cotton, and into the homes of other future leaders of colonial America. And these worldly stories were as racist as they were amazing.
Chapter 3. Coming to America. Explorers wrote about their adventures, and their tales fascinated Europeans. This new travel literature gave Europeans sitting by their firesides a window into faraway lands where different-looking people resided, in cultures that seemed exotic and strange. But the literary glimpses that explorers provided of African lands were usually overshadowed by the self-interest of the backers of the expeditions, who aimed most of all to fulfill their colonizing and slave-trading desires. Even a lonely abolitionist, French philosopher Jean Bodin, found his thoughts bogged down by tales connecting 2 simultaneous discoveries, that of West Africans and that of the dark, tailless apes walking around like humans in West Africa. Africa's heat had produced hypersexual Africans, Bodin theorized in 1576, and intimate relations between the men and beasts still give birth to monsters in Africa. The climate theory of Africa's hot sun transforming the people into uncivil beasts of burden still held the court of racist opinion, but not much longer. For English travel writer George Best, climate theory fell apart when he saw on an Arctic voyage in 1577 that the Inuit people in northeastern Canada were darker than the people living in the hotter south. In a 1578 account of the expedition, Best shied away from climate theory in explaining the Ethiopians' blackness. He found an alternative, Holy Scripture, or the curse theory that had recently been articulated by a Dominican friar in Peru and a handful of French intellectuals, a theory more enticing to slaveholders. In Best's whimsical interpretation of Genesis, Noah orders his white and angel-like sons to abstain from sex with their wives on the ark, and then tells them that the first child born after the flood would inherit the earth. When the evil, tyrannical, and hypersexual Ham has sex on the ark, God wills that Ham's descendants shall be so black and loathsome in Best's telling that it might remain a spectacle of disobedience to all the world. The first major debate between races had invaded the English discourse. This argument about the cause of inferior blackness, curse or climate, nature or nurture, would rage for decades and eventually influence settlers to America. Curse theorists were the first known segregationists. They believed that black people were naturally and permanently inferior and totally incapable of becoming white. Climate theorists were the first known assimilationists, believing black people had been nurtured by the hot sun into a temporary inferiority, but were capable of becoming white if they moved to a cooler climate. George Best produced his curse theory in 1578, in the era between Henry VII and Oliver Cromwell, a time during which the English nation was experiencing the snowballing, conflicting passions of overseas adventure and domestic control, or to use historian Winthrop Jordan's words, of voyages of discovery overseas and inward voyages of discovery. The mercantile expansion abroad, the progressively commercialized economy at home, the fabulous profits, the exciting adventure stories, and the class warfare all destabilized the social order in Elizabethan England, a social order being intensely scrutinized by the rising congregation of morally strict, hyper-dictating, pious Puritans. George Best used Africans as social mirrors, to use Jordan's phrase, for the hypersexuality, greed, and lack of discipline, the devil's machinations that he found first in England but could not speak of. Normalizing negative behavior in faraway African people allowed writers to denormalize negative behavior in white people, to denormalize what they witnessed during intense appraisals of self and nation. Probably no one in England collected and read travel stories more eagerly than Richard Hakluyt. In 1589, he published his travel collection in the Principal Navigations, Voyages, and Discoveries of the English Nation. In issuing this monumental collection of nearly all the available documents describing British overseas adventures, Hakluyt urged explorers, traders, and missionaries to fulfill their superior destiny to civilize, Christianize, capitalize, and command the world. The Puritans believed, too, in civilizing and Christianizing the world, but their approach to the project was slightly different from that of most explorers and expedition sponsors. For the others, it was about economic returns or political power. For Puritan preachers, it was about bringing social order to the world. Cambridge professor William Perkins rested at the cornerstone of British Puritanism in the late 16th century. Though the servant in regard of faith and the inner man be equal to his master, in regard of the outward man, the master is above the servant, he explained in Ordering a Family, published in 1590. In paraphrasing St. Paul, Perkins became one of the first major English theorists, or assimilationist theologians, to be more precise, to match the exploitative master-servant or master-slave relationship as a loving family relationship. He thus added to Zurara's justifying theory of Portuguese enslavers nurturing African beasts. For generations to come, assimilationist slaveholders from Richard Mather's New England to Hispaniola would shrewdly use this loving family mask to cover up the exploitation and brutality of slavery. It was Perkinson's family ordering that Puritan leaders like John Cotton and Richard Mather used to sanction slavery in Massachusetts a generation later. And it was Perkinson's claims of equal souls and unequal bodies that led Puritan preachers like Cotton and Mather to minister to African souls and not challenge the enslavement of their bodies. Richard Mather was born in 1596 in northeastern England at the height of William Perkinson's influence. After Perkins died in 1602, Puritan Paul Bain succeeded him at Cambridge. Richard Mather closely studied Baines' writings, and he probably could quote his most famous treatise, Commentary on Ephesians. In the commentary, Baines said slavery was partly a curse for sins and partly a result of civil condition or barbarism. Black Moors were slavish, he said, and he urged slaves to be cheerfully obedient. Masters were to show their superiority through kindness and through a display of a white, sincere heart. As Richard Mather came of age, Richard Hakluyt was establishing himself as England's greatest promoter of overseas colonization. Hakluyt surrounded himself with a legion of travel writers, translators, explorers, traders, investors, colonizers, everyone who might play a role in colonizing the world, and began mentoring them. In 1597, he urged mentee John Pory, a recent Cambridge graduate, to complete a translation that may have been on Hakluyt's list for quite some time. Pory translated Leo Africanus' Geographical Histories of Africa into English in 1600. English readers consumed it as quickly as other Europeans had for decades, and they were just as impressed. In a long introduction, Pory argued that climate theory could not explain the geographical distinctions in color. They must be hereditary, Pory suggested. Africans were descended from Ham, the cursed son of Noah. Whether they chose to illuminate the stamp of blackness through curse theory or climate theory, the travel writers and translators of the time had a larger common goal, and they accomplished it. They ushered in the British Age of Adventure. They were soon followed by another group, the playwrights. With the English literacy rate low, many more British imaginations were churned by playwrights than by travel writers. At the turn of the century, a respected London playwright from Stratford-upon-Avon was escorting English audiences back into the ancient world and around modern Europe from Scotland, Macbeth, to Denmark, Hamlet, to inferior blackness and superior whiteness in Italy, the tragedy of Othello, the Moor of Venice. The racial politics of William Shakespeare's Othello did not surprise English audiences when it premiered in 1604. By the late 1500s, English dramatists were used to manufacturing Satan's black agents on Earth. Shakespeare's first black character, the evil, oversexed Aaron in Titus Andronicus, first came to the stage in 1594. Down in Spain, dramatists frequently staged black people as cruel idiots in the genre called Comedias de Negros. Shakespeare's Othello is a Moorish Christian general in the Venetian military, a character inspired by the 1565 Italian tale Gli Hecatomathi and possibly Leo Africanus, the Christian Moor in Italy who despised his blackness. Othello's trusted ensign, Iago, resents Othello for marrying the Venetian Desdemona. "For that I do suspect the lusty Moor hath leaped into my seat," Iago explains. To Desdemona's father, Iago labels Othello an old black ram, tupping your white hue. Iago manipulates Othello to make him believe his wife betrayed him. Her name, that was as fresh as Diane's visage, is now begrimmed and black as mine own face, Othello says before strangling Desdemona. At the play's climax, Othello realizes his dead wife's innocence and confesses to Emilia, Desdemona's maidservant. "Oh, the more angel she," Emilia responds, "and you the blacker devil." Othello commits suicide. The theater-loving Queen Elizabeth did not see Othello, as she did some of Shakespeare's earlier plays. She died in 1603. When the deadly plague of 1604 subsided, her successor, King James I, arrived in London and started making plans for his grand coronation. King James I and his wife, Queen Anne of Denmark, saw Othello. But King James I commissioned Shakespeare's rival playwright, Ben Jonson, to produce an alluring international mask for his coronation, and to mark the end of Elizabethan self-isolation. Queen Anne proposed an African theme to reflect the new king's international focus. Leo Africanus, travel stories, and Othello had sparked the queen's interest in Africa. Satisfying his queen, Jonson wrote The Mask of Blackness. Premiering on January 7, 1605, in the Great Hall of London's sparkling Whitehall Palace that overlooks the snowy banks of the Thames River, The Mask of Blackness was the most expensive production ever presented in London. Its elaborate costumes, exciting dancing, sensational choirs, booming orchestras, exotic scenery, and a luxurious banquet caused all in attendance to marvel at the spectacle. Inspired by climate theory, it was the story of 12 ugly African princesses of the river god Niger who learned they could be made beautiful if they traveled to Britannia, where the sunbeams shine day and night and are a force to blanch an Ethiop and revive a corpse. Queen Anne herself and 11 court ladies played the African princesses in blackface, inaugurating the use of black paint on the royal stage. The Mask of Blackness presented the imperial vision of King James I, Prince Charles, Richard Hakluyt, and a powerful lineup of English investors, merchants, missionaries, and explorers, and it helped renew British determination to expand Britannia to America. King James chartered the London Company in 1606 with his eyes on North America, one eye on Virginia, another on New England. Although misfortune plagued the New England undertakings, Virginia fared better. Captain John Smith, a mentee of Richard Hakluyt, helped command the expedition of roughly 150 volunteers on the three boats that entered the Chesapeake Bay on April 26, 1607. Against all odds, and thanks to the assistance of the indigenous Powhatan Americans, North America's first permanent English settlement survived. His mission accomplished, John Smith returned as a hero to England in October 1609. In colonizing Virginia and later New England, the British had already begun to conceive of distinct races. The word race first appeared in Frenchman Jacques de Brez's 1481 poem, The Hunt, where it referred to hunting dogs. As the term expanded to include humans over the next century, it was used primarily to identify and differentiate and animalize African people. The term did not appear in a dictionary until 1606, when French diplomat Jean Nicot included an entry for it. Race means descent, he explained, and it is said that a man, a horse, a dog, or another animal is from good or bad race. Thanks to this malleable concept in Western Europe, the British were free to lump the multi-ethnic Native Americans and the multi-ethnic Africans into the same racial groups. In time, Nicot's construction became as addictive as the tobacco plant he introduced in France. Captain John Smith never returned to Jamestown. He spent the rest of his life as the greatest literary mentee of Richard Hakluyt, promoting British migration to America. Thousands crossed the Atlantic moved by Smith's exhilarating travel books, which by 1624 included his tale of Pocahontas saving his life. Pocahontas, the civilized savage, had by then converted to Christianity, married an Englishman, and visited London. The English approved. Black people did not fare so well in Smith's estimation. Settlers read his worldly, or rather racist, opinions, though, and adopted them as their own. In his final book, published the year of his death in 1631, Smith told unexperienced New England planters that the enslaved Africans were as idle and as devilish as any in the world. Apparently, Smith thought this knowledge would be useful to planters, probably knowing it was only a matter of time before enslaved Africans were brought to New England. But Smith was only recasting ideas he had heard in England between the Mask of Blackness, the founding of Virginia, and the founding of New England, ideas English intellectuals had probably learned from Spanish enslavers and Portuguese slave traders. "Men that have low and flat nostrils are as libidinous as apes," cleric Edward Topsail explained in 1607 in History of Four-Footed Beasts. King James made the common association of apes and devils in his 1597 book, Demonology. In one of his last plays, The Tempest, 1611, Shakespeare played on these associations of the ape and devil and African in crafting Caliban, the hypersexual bastard child of a demon and an African witch from a vile race. In 1614, England's first famous working-class poet, John Taylor, said that black nations adored the black devil. In a 1615 address for the planters in Ireland and Virginia, the Reverend Thomas Cooper said that white Shem, one of Noah's three sons, shall be lord over the cursed race of Cham, meaning Noah's son Ham in Africa. Future Virginia politician George Sanders also conjured curse theory to degrade blackness. In a 1620 paraphrase of Genesis, future politician Thomas Paine wrote of Cain, or the southern man, as a black deformed elf, and the northern white, like unto God himself. 5 years later, clergyman Samuel Purchas released the gargantuan four-volume Hakluytus Posthumus of travel manuscripts left to him by his mentor, Richard Hakluyt. Purchas blasted the filthy, sodomites, sleepers, ignorant, beast, disciples of Cham, to whom the black darkness is reserved forever. These were the ideas about African people circulating throughout England and the English colonies as African people were being hauled into Britannia on slave ships. In 1619, Richard Mather began ministering not far from the future center of the British slave trade, the port of Liverpool. In those days, the British slave trade was minuscule and Africans hardly existed in Britannia. But that would soon change. The vessels of slave traders were cruising deeper and deeper into the heart of West Africa, especially after the Moroccans, armed by English guns, crushed the Songhai Empire in 1591. The vessels of English commerce were cruising deeper and deeper into Virginia, too, as English merchants competed with the Spanish, Portuguese, and rising Dutch and French empires. The first recorded slave ship to arrive in colonial America, laden with African people, was not originally intended for the English colonies. The Spanish ship San Juan Batista departed Angola in July 1619, hauling 350 captives, probably headed for Veracruz, Mexico. Latin American slaveholders had used racist ideas to craft a permanent slavery for the quarter of a million Africans they held at that time. Two pirate ships probably attacked the Spanish ship in the Gulf of Mexico, snatching some 60 captives and then headed east. Weeks later, in August 1619, the pirates sold 20 of their Angolan captives in Jamestown to Virginia Governor George Yeardley, the owner of 1,000 acres. John Pori, the translator of Leo the African's book into English, was Yeardley's cousin, and he ventured to Jamestown in 1619 to serve as Yeardley's secretary. On July 30th, 1619, Yeardley convened the inaugural meeting of elected politicians in colonial America, a group that included Thomas Jefferson's great-grandfather. These lawmakers named John Pori their speaker. The English translator of Leo the African's book, who had defended climate theory, thus became colonial America's first legislative leader. John Pori set the price of America's first cash crop, tobacco, and recognized the need for labor to grow it. So when the Angolans bound for slavery arrived in August, they were right on time. There is no reason to believe that George Yeardley and the other original enslavers did not rationalize their permanent enslavement of African people in the same way that other British intellectuals did, and in the same way that Latin American slaveholders did, by considering these African people to be stamped from the beginning as a racially distinct people, as lower than themselves, and as lower in the scale of being than the more populous and temporary white indentured servants. The 1625 Virginia census did not list the ages or dates of arrival for most Africans, nor did the census list any of them, despite in some cases the fact that they had resided in Virginia for 6 years, as free. Africans were recorded as distinct from white servants. When Yeardley died in 1627, he willed to his heirs his goods, debts, chattels, servants, niggars, cattle, or any other thing. Niggars were dropped below servants in the social hierarchy to reflect the economic hierarchy. And this stratification became clear in Virginia's first judicial decision, explicitly referring to race. The court ordered a white man in 1630 to be soundly whipped before an assembly of Negroes and others for abusing himself to the dishonor of God and the shame of Christianity by defiling his body and lying with a Negro. The court contrasted the polluted black woman and the pure white woman with whom he could lie without defiling his body. It was the first recorded instance of gender racism in America, of considering the body of the black woman to be a tainted object that could defile a white man upon contact. Richard Mather never saw a slave ship leave the Liverpool docks during his ministerial tenure in Toxteth in the 1620s. Liverpool did not become England's main slave ship station until the 1740s, succeeding London and Bristol. British slave traders were slowly expanding their activities in the 1620s, unlike all those Anglican persecutors of Puritans. The death of King James and the coronation of his son, Charles I, in 1625, set off a persecuting stampede. William Ames, a disciple of William Perkins, who was exiled in Holland, stilled Richard Mather, John Cotton, and countless other Puritans with the marrow of sacred divinity. Translated from Latin into English in 1627, the treatise described the sacred divinity of spiritual equality between a free man and a servant. The sacred divinity of inferiors, owing subjection and obedience to their superiors, and the sacred divinity of our blood kin, being given more love than strangers. The Marrow's explanation became a guiding principle for Mather's generations of Puritans settling the Massachusetts Bay Area in the late 1620s and 1630s. Puritans used this doctrine when assessing Native American and African strangers, ensuring intolerance from the start in their land of tolerance. Beginning in 1642, Anglican monarchists and nonconforming parliamentarians locked arms in the English Civil War. As New England Puritans welcomed the nonconforming parliamentarians, Virginia's royalists prayed for their retreating King Charles I. But in 1649, he was executed. 3 years later, Virginia was forced to surrender to the new ruling parliament. The economic hierarchy that had emerged in Virginia resembled the pecking order that William Ames had proposed and that Puritans established in New England, although their political and religious allegiances differed. Large planters and ministers and merchants stood at the top, men like John Martram of Virginia's Northern Neck, who used his power to acquire fertile land, solicit trade, procure labor, and keep legally free people like Elizabeth Key enslaved. Elizabeth Key was the daughter of an unnamed African woman and Newport News legislator Thomas Key. Before his death, Thomas had arranged for his biracial daughter to be freed at age 15. Her subsequent masters, however, kept her enslaved. At some point, she adopted Christianity. She birthed a baby, whose father was William Greenstead, an English indentured servant and amateur lawyer on Mottram's plantation. Upon Mottram's death in 1655, Key and Greenstead successfully sued the estate for her and her child's freedom. Virginia planters followed the Key case almost as closely as they followed the English Civil War. They realized that the English common laws regarding not enslaving Christians and stipulating that the father's status determined the child's status both superseded curse theory, climate theory, beast theory, evangelical theory, and every other racist theory substantiating black and biracial enslavement. Elizabeth Key had ravaged the ties that planters had unofficially used to bind African slavery. For Virginia planters, the timing of the Key case could not have been worse. By the 1660s, labor demands had grown. Virginians had uprooted more indigenous communities to expand their farmlands. Landowners were looking increasingly to African laborers to do the work, since their lower death rates made them more valuable and more permanent than temporary indentures. At the same time, the bloody English Civil War that had driven so many from England to America had come to a close, and new socioeconomic opportunities in England slowed the flow of voluntary indentured migrants. The white servants still arriving partnered with the enslaved Africans in escapes and rebellions, possibly bonding on similar stories of apprehension, being lured onto ships on the western coasts of Africa or Europe. Planters responded to labor demands and laborers' unity by purchasing more African people and luring whiteness away from blackness. In the first official recognition of slavery in Virginia, legislators stipulated in 1660, and in stricter terms in 1661, that any white servant running away in company with any Negroes shall serve for the time of the said Negro's absence, even if it meant life. In 1662, Virginia lawmen plugged one of Key's freedom loopholes to resolve doubts that have arisen whether children got by an Englishman upon a Negro woman should be slave or free. They proclaimed that all children born in this country derived their status from the condition of the mother. Trashing English law, they dusted off the Roman principle of partus sequitur venturum, which held that among tame and domestic animals, the brood belongs to the owner of the dam or mother. With this law in place, white enslavers could now reap financial reward from relations upon a Negro woman. But they wanted to prevent the limited number of white women from engaging in similar interracial relations as their biracial babies would become free. In 1664, Maryland legislators declared it a disgrace to our nation when English women intermarry with Negro slaves. By the end of the century, Maryland and Virginia legislators had enacted severe penalties for white women in relationships with non-white men. In this way, heterosexual white men freed themselves through racist laws to engage in sexual relations with all women. And then their racist literature codified their sexual privileges. The Isle of Pines, a bizarre short story published in 1668 by former English parliamentarian Henry Neville, gave readers one such ominous account. The tale purposefully begins in 1589, the year the first edition of Richard Hakluyt's Principal Navigations appeared. Surviving a shipwreck in the Indian Ocean, George Pines finds himself alone on an uninhabited island with an English 14-year-old, a Welsh maidservant, another maidservant, whose whiteness is clear and ethnicity is not, and one Negro female slave. For Pines, idleness and fullness of everything begot in me a desire of enjoying the women. He persuades the two maids to lie with him, and then reports that the English 14-year-old was content also to do as we did. The Negro woman, seeing what we did, longed also for her share. One night, the uniquely sexually aggressive black woman makes her move in the darkness while Pines sleeps. The Isle of Pines was one of the first portrayals in British letters of aggressive, hypersexual African femininity. Such portrayals served both to exonerate white men of their inhuman rapes and to mask their human attractions to the supposed beast-like women. And the portrayals just kept coming, like the slave ships. Meanwhile, American enslavers publicly prostituted African women well into the 18th century, privately thereafter. In a 1736 exchange of letters on the inextricable sexuality and service of African ladies, single white men were counseled in the South Carolina Gazette to wait for the next shipping from the coast of Guinea.
Those African ladies are of a strong, robust constitution, not easily jaded out, able to serve them by night as well as day. On their Isles of Pines in colonial America, white men continue to depict African women as sexually aggressive, shifting the responsibility of their own sexual desires to the women. Of the nearly 100 reports of rape or attempted rape in 21 newspapers in 9 American colonies between 1728 and 1776, none reported the rape of a black woman. Rapes of black women by men of all races were not considered newsworthy. Like raped prostitutes, black women's credibility had been stolen by racist beliefs in their hypersexuality. For black men, the story was similar. There was not a single article in the colonial era announcing the acquittal of a suspected black male rapist. One-third of white men mentioned in rape articles were acknowledged as being acquitted of at least one charge. Moreover, newspaper reports of rape constructed white defendants as individual offenders and black defendants as representative of the failings of their racial group, according to journalism historian Sharon Block. Already, the American mind was accomplishing that indispensable intellectual activity of someone consumed with racist ideas, individualizing white negativity and generalizing black negativity. Negative behavior by any black person became proof of what was wrong with black people, while negative behavior by any white person only proved what was wrong with that person. Black women were thought to aggressively pursue white men sexually, and black men were thought to aggressively pursue white women sexually. Neither could help it, the racist myth posited. They naturally craved superior whiteness. Black women possessed a temper hot and lascivious, making no scruple to prostitute themselves to the Europeans for a very slender profit. So great is their inclination to white men, dreamt William Smith, the author of New Voyage to Guinea in 1744. And all of this lasciviousness on the part of black men and women stemmed from their relatively large genitalia, the theory went. As early as 1482, Italian cartographer Jamie Bertrand depicted Mali Emperor Mansa Musa almost naked on his throne with oversized genitals. Some white men were honest enough to broadcast their attractions, usually justifying them with assimilationist ideas. Royalist Richard Ligon, exiled from parliamentary England in Barbados, sat at a dinner adoring the black mistress of the colony's governor. Barbados had become richer than all the other British colonies combined by the mid-1600s. Sugar was planted right up to the steps of homes, and the residents ate New England food instead of growing their own. To Ligon, the black mistress had the greatest beauty and majesty together that ever I saw in one woman, exceeding Queen Anne of Denmark. Ligon presented her with a gift after the dinner. She responded with the loveliest smile that I have ever seen. It was impossible for Ligon to tell what was whiter, her teeth or the whites of her eyes. This was one of the many small stories that made up Ligon's A True and Exact History of the Island of Barbados in 1657, the year Elizabeth Key's case was finally settled. In one story, a submissive slave named Sambo tells on his fellows who are planning a slave revolt and refuses his reward. In another, Ligon informs a cruel master of Sambo's desire to be made a Christian. By English law, we cannot make a Christian a slave, the master responds. My request was far different from that, Ligon replies, for I desired him to make a slave a Christian. If Sambo becomes a Christian, he can no longer be enslaved, the master says, and it will open such a gap that all of the planters in the island will be upset. Ligon lamented that Sambo was to be kept out of the church, but at the same time, he gave enslavers a new theory to defend their enterprise. Blacks were naturally docile, and slaves could and should become Christians. Planters had feared the conversion of slaves because they believed that if their slaves were Christian, they would have to be freed, and Elizabeth Key's successful suit showed that the laws supported this belief. Ligon's distinction between making a Christian a slave and a slave a Christian turned this idea on its head. Though it took time, eventually it became the basis for closing the religious loophole Key had exposed. Ligon lifted the biblical law of converting the unconverted over British law, barring the enslavement of Christians. He promoted the idea of baptizing enslaved Africans through the docile figure of Sambo, and planters and intellectuals almost certainly got the point, submissive, confessing Sambo desired Christianity, and he should be permitted to have it. Indeed, Christianity would only make slaves more docile. Ligon's recommendation of Christianizing the slave for docility appeared during a crucial time of intellectual innovation. And as intellectual ideas abounded, justifications for slavery abounded, too. On November 28, 1660, a dozen men gathered in London and founded what became known as the Royal Society. Europe's scientific revolution had reached England. Italians initiated the Accademia di Lincei in 1603. The French L'Académie Française was founded in 1635, and the Germans established their national academy, Leopoldina, in 1652. King Charles II chartered the Royal Society as one of the first acts of his restored anti-Puritan monarchy in 1660. One of the early leaders of the Royal Society was one of England's most celebrated young scholars, the author of The Skeptical Chemist, 1661. And the father of English chemistry, Robert Boyle. In 1665, Boyle urged his European peers to compile more natural histories of foreign lands and peoples, with Richard Ligon's History of Barbados serving as the racist prototype. The year before, Boyle had jumped into the ring of the racial debate with Of the Nature of Whiteness and Blackness. He rejected both curse and climate theorists, and knocked up a foundational anti-racist idea. The seat of human pigmentation seems to be but the thin epidermis or outward skin, he wrote. And yet, this anti-racist idea of skin color being only skin deep did not stop Boyle from judging different colors. Black skin, he maintained, was an ugly deformity of normal whiteness. The physics of light, Boyle argued, showed that whiteness was the chiefest color. He claimed to have ignored his personal opinions and clearly and faithfully presented the truth, as his Royal Society deeded. As Boyle and the Royal Society promoted the innovation and circulation of racist ideas, they promoted objectivity in all their writings. Intellectuals from Geneva to Boston, including Richard Mather's youngest son, Increase Mather, carefully read and loudly hailed Boyle's work in 1664. A 22-year-old unremarkable Cambridge student from a farming family copied full quotations, as he rose in stature over the next 40 years to become one of the most influential scientists of all time, Isaac Newton took it upon himself to substantiate Boyle's color law. Light is white is standard. In 1704, a year after he assumed the presidency of the Royal Society, Newton released one of the most eminent books of the modern era, Optics. Whiteness is produced by the convention of all colors, he wrote. Newton created a color wheel to illustrate his thesis. The center was white of the first order, and all the other colors were positioned in relation to their distance from whiteness. In one of the foundational books of the upcoming European intellectual renaissance, Newton imagined perfect whiteness. Robert Boyle would not live to read Optics. He died after a long and influential life in 1691. During his lifetime, he did not merely found chemistry. White and light, power the Royal Society, and inspire Isaac Newton, the Mather clan, and throngs of intellectuals on both sides of the Atlantic. Boyle sat on the original Council for Foreign Plantations in 1660, which was commissioned concurrently with the Royal Society to centralize and advise the vast empire that Charles II inherited. In 1661, Boyle's council made its first formal plea to planters in Barbados, Maryland, and Virginia to convert enslaved Africans. This act shall not impede, restrain, or impair the power of masters, the council made sure to note. The council's pleas resounded louder and louder each year as the plantation economy surged across the Western Hemisphere, as a growing flock of powerful British ministers vied for submission of African souls, and as planters vied for submission of their bodies. Missionaries endeavored to grow God's kingdom, as planters endeavored to grow profits. The marriage of Christian slavery seemed destined, but enslaved Africans balked. The vast majority of Africans in early America firmly resisted the religion of their masters, and their masters balked too. Enslavers would not, or could not, listen to sermons to convert their slaves. Saving their crops each year was more important to them than saving souls. But of course they could not say that and risk angering their ministers. Enslavers routinely defended their inaction by claiming that enslaved Africans were too barbaric to be converted. The racist debate over the cause of blackness, climate or curse, had been joined by this new racist debate over the black capability for Christianity. The segregationist belief that enslaved Africans should not or could not be baptized was so widespread and so taboo to discuss, as Richard Ligon found in Barbados, that virtually no enslaver took to writing to defend it in a major piece in the 1600s. That did not stop the assimilationists, who believed that lowly enslaved Africans, practicing their supposed animalistic religions, were capable of being raised to Christianity. In the 1660s, there emerged a missionary movement to publicize this divine duty to resistant slaveholders and slaves. Richard Mather's grandson spent his adult life carrying this movement to the churches of New England, but Mather did not live to see it.
Chapter 4. Saving Souls, Not Bodies. When Charles II restored the English throne in 1660, he restored the religious persecution of Puritans. Roughly 2,000 Puritan ministers were forced out of the Church of England during the Great Ejection. In New England, Richard Mather had lost some hearing and sight in one eye, but he was still as defiant to the crown as he had been as a younger man, and he steered New England nonconformist as adroitly as he had done for three decades. His fellow theological captain, John Cotton, had died in 1652. His first wife had also died, and Mather had married Cotton's widow, Sarah Hankrich Story Cotton. His youngest son, Increase Mather, married Sarah's daughter, now his stepsister, Maria Cotton, further interlacing the ties between the famous Mathers and Cottons. As if to triple knot the family tie, Increase and Sarah named their first son, upon his birth on February 12, 1663, Cotton Mather. Richard Mather lived 6 years after the birth of his grandson. When he died, Increase Mather honored his father by writing his biography, putting in print Richard Mather's providential deliverance from the Great Hurricane of 1635, a story as meaningful to the Mather lineage as any passage in the Bible. Increase Mather, who took the helm of John Cotton's famed North Church of Boston in 1664, taught all 10 of his eventual children that they were regular receivers of divine providence like their grandfather. Increase especially expressed this exceptionality to Cotton Mather. In time, Cotton would make his father a prophet. He combined the best of the Cottons and Mathers, eclipsing them all in America's historical memory. By the century's end, African slavery sounded as natural to the colonist as the name Cotton Mather, and hardly any intellectual was more responsible for this binding than Cotton Mather himself. Cotton Mather was not the sole progenitor of such ideas, however. He was influenced by the books he read by his contemporaries, and few, if any, books influenced Cotton Mather's racist ideas more than Richard Baxter's A Christian Directory. From his British ministerial post in Kidderminster, Richard Baxter urged slaveholders across the ocean to follow God's law in making slaves into Christians in his well-traveled treatise, A Christian Directory, 1664 to 1665. He told them to make it your chief end in buying and using slaves, to win them to Christ and save their souls. Be sure to let their salvation be far more valued by you than their service. Although he was at the head of the missionary movement, Baxter was not alone in proselytizing to African people. As early as 1657, English dissenter George Fox prevailed on his newly founded religious society of Friends, or Quakers, to convert the enslaved. Eschewing church hierarchies and preaching that everyone had access to the inward light of God, the Quakers seemed primed to one day produce abolitionists and anti-racists. In an effort to square his Christian faith, or his nation's Christian faith, with slavery, Baxter tried to argue that some kind of benevolent slavery was possible and would be helpful for African people. These assimilationist ideas of Christianizing and civilizing enslaved Africans were particularly dangerous because they gave convincing power to the idea that slavery was just and should not be resisted. And so Baxter, a non-conforming Puritan, conformed and conformed his Puritan readers to most, though certainly not all, of the racist policies of Charles II's expanding slaveholding empire. People who have forfeited life or liberty can be enslaved, Baxter wrote. However, to go as pirates and catch up poor Negroes is one of the worst kind of thievery in the world. Enslavers that buy them and use them as beasts and neglect their souls are fitter to be called incarnate devils than Christians.
Baxter naively believed there existed in bulk in the slave trade what he called a voluntary slave. He tried to will into existence a world where loving masters bought voluntary slaves to save their souls. Baxter's world remained a heavenly dream crafted long ago by Gomez Yanez de Zarara. But even that dream world was seen as a threat by enslavers. American enslavers were still afraid to baptize Africans because Christian slaves, like Elizabeth Key, could sue for their freedom. The colonies moved quickly to legalize the proselytizing demands of missionaries like Richard Baxter and to hush the freedom cries from Christian slaves. In 1667, Virginia decreed that the conferring of baptism doth not alter the condition of the person as to his bondage. New York did the same in 1664, as did Maryland in 1671. May more masters, the Virginian legislators inscribed, carefully endeavor the propagation of Christianity to slaves. Masters were supposed to care for the resisting souls of their captives. But what about their resisting bodies? In 1667, the English Parliament empowered masters to control the wild, barbarous, and savage nature of enslaved Africans only with strict severity. And in 1669, the personal physician of Lord Anthony Ashley Cooper, one of the lords proprietor of the province of Carolina, in his draft of the original Fundamental Constitution of the Carolinas, awarded the founding planters of the province absolute power and authority over their captives. When John Locke moved to London in 1667 to become the personal physician of Lord Cooper, he had much more to offer the colonizing British politician than his medical expertise. He had studied at the feet of Robert Boyle after his educational tenure at Oxford, and he had ended up collecting more travel books than philosophy texts for his immense personal library. Lord Cooper asked Locke to draw up the Carolinas Constitution and serve as the secretary of the proprietors and soon the Council of Trade and Plantations and the Board of Trade and Plantations. Not many Englishmen were more knowledgeable or less compassionate than Locke about British colonialism and slavery. "You should feel nothing at all of others' misfortune," Locke advised a friend in 1670. Between all his colonial and medical duties, by July 1671, Locke had written the first draft of his lasting philosophical monument, an essay concerning human understanding. Over the next two decades, he revised and expanded the essay before its grand appearance in four books in 1689. That year, Locke also released his two treatises of government, attacking monarchy, requesting a government with the consent of the governed, and distinguishing between temporary servants and slaves, who being captives taken in a just war, are by the right of nature subjected to the absolute dominion and arbitrary power of their masters. Just as Richard Baxter had pushed his voluntary slave theory to defend slavery in his Free Christian Society, John Locke pushed his just war theory to defend slavery in his Free Civil Society. "In any society, the mind at first is rasa tabula," Locke famously wrote in an essay concerning human understanding. "If people are born without innate intelligence, then there cannot be a natural intellectual hierarchy." But Locke's egalitarian idea had a caveat. As Boyle and Newton painted unblemished light white, Locke more or less painted the unblemished mind white. Locke used the term white paper much more often than blank slate or tabula rasa to describe the child's as yet unprejudiced understanding. Locke also touched on the origin of species in an essay concerning human understanding. "Apes, whether these be all men, or no, all of human species, depended on one's definition of the word man, because he said, if history lie not, then West African women had conceived babies with apes." Locke thus reinforced African female hypersexuality in a passage sent round the English-speaking world. "And what real species, by that measure, such a production will be in nature, will be a new question." Locke's new question reflected another new racist debate that most debaters feared to engage in publicly. Assimilationists argued monogenesis, that all humans were one species descended from a single human creation in Europe's Garden of Eden. Segregationists argued the heresy of polygenesis, that there were multiple origins of multiple human species. Ever since Europeans had laid eyes on Native Americans in 1492, a people unmentioned in the Bible, they had started questioning the biblical creation story. Some speculated that Native Americans had to have descended from a different Adam. By the end of the 16th century, European thinkers had added African people to the list of species descended from a different Adam. In 1616, Italian freethinker Lucilio Vanini said, as Locke suggested later, that Ethiopians and apes must have the same ancestry, distinct from Europeans. But no one made the case for polygenesis as stoutly as French theologian Isaac La Perrière in Pri Adamitai in 1655. Translated into English in 1656, Men Before Adam was publicly burned in Paris and banned from Europe after Locke secured a copy. Christians tossed La Perrière in prison and burned Vanini at the stake for defying the Christian monogenesis story of Adam and Eve, but they could not stop the drift of polygenesis. To justify black enslavement, Barbados planters actually preferred the polygenesis theory over the curse theory of Ham, according to eyewitness Morgan Godwin. Godwin made this revelation in a 1680 pamphlet that criticized racist planters for making those two words, Negro and slave, synonymous while white was the general name for Europeans. This Anglican brought his missionary zeal from Virginia to Barbados in the 1670s. He stood at the forefront of his denomination's efforts to baptize enslaved Africans, aping a Quaker named William Edmondson. In 1675, a war more destructive than the Great Hurricane of 1635 ravaged New England. 3,000 Native Americans and 600 settlers were killed, and numerous towns and burgeoning economies were destroyed during King Philip's War. In the midst of the carnage, William Edmondson, who had founded Quakerism in Ireland, arrived in Rhode Island, reeling from his failure to convert enslaved Africans in Barbados. When his failures continued in Rhode Island, he began to understand that slavery was holding back his missions, and he told slave-owning Quakers as much in a letter in 1676. Edmondson had an assimilationist vision, a vision to restrain and reclaim African people from their accustomed filthy, unclean practices and defiling each other. Quaker self-denial of human property could be known to all. Abolitionist ideas blossomed again a dozen years later among the Mennonite and Quaker founders of Germantown in Philadelphia. This time, without Edmondson's assimilationist ideas. Mennonites were an Anabaptist denomination born out of the Protestant Reformation in the German and Dutch-speaking areas of Central Europe. During the 16th and early 17th centuries, Orthodox authorities lethally persecuted the Mennonites. The Mennonites did not intend to leave behind one site of oppression to build another in America. Mennonites therefore circulated an anti-slavery petition on April 18, 1688. There is a saying that we shall do to all men like as we will be done ourselves, making no difference of what generation, descent, or color they are, they wrote. In Europe, there are many oppressed for their religion, and here those are oppressed for their black color. Both oppressions were wrong. Actually, as an oppressor, America surpassed Holland and Germany. Africans had the right to fight for their freedom. The 1688 Germantown petition against slavery was the inaugural anti-racist tract among European settlers in colonial America. Beginning with this piece, the Golden Rule would forever inspire the cause of white anti-racists. Anti-racists of all races, whether out of altruism or intelligent self-interest, would always recognize that preserving racial hierarchy simultaneously preserves ethnic, gender, class, sexual, age, and religious hierarchies. Human hierarchies of all kinds, they understood, would do little more than oppress all of humanity. But powerful slaveholding Philadelphia Quakers killed the Germantown petition out of economic self-interest. William Edmondson had likewise suffered for promoting anti-slavery arguments a dozen years earlier. Slaveholding Quakers across New England had banished Edmondson from their meetings. The elderly founder of the American Baptist Church, Rhode Island's Roger Williams, called Edmondson nothing but a bundle of ignorance. Not many New Englanders read Edmondson's letter to slaveholding Quakers, and not many noticed its significance. Everyone was focused on King Philip's War. In early August 1676, Increase Mather, the theological scion of New England with his father dead, implored God from sunup to sundown to cut down King Philip, or Metacomet, the Native American war leader. The conflict had been worsening for a little over a year, and the Puritans had lost homes and dozens of soldiers. Less than a week after Mather's prayer campaign, Metacomet was killed, more or less ending the war. Puritans cut up his body as if it were a hog's. A nearly 14-year-old Cotton Mather detached Metacomet's jaw from his skull. Puritans then paraded the king's remains around Plymouth. Down in Virginia, Governor George Berkeley was trying to avoid a totally different war with neighboring Native Americans, in part to avoid disrupting his profitable fur trade. 29-year-old frontier planter Nathaniel Bacon had other plans. The racial laws passed in the 1660s had done little to diminish class conflict. Around April 1676, Bacon mobilized a force of frontier white laborers to redirect their anger from elite whites to Susquehannocks. Bacon's mind game worked. Since my being with the volunteers, the discourse and earnestness of the people is against the Indians, Bacon wrote to Berkeley in triumph. Berkeley charged Bacon with treason, more worried about armed landless whites, the rabble crew, than the Susquehannocks and nearby Okanichees. But Bacon was not so easily stopped. By summer, the frontier war had quickly become a civil war, or to some, a class war, with Bacon and his supporters rebelling against Berkeley, and Berkeley hiring a militia of mercenaries. By September 1676, a defiant Bacon had proclaimed liberty to all servants and Negroes. For Governor Berkeley's wealthy white inner circle, poor whites and enslaved blacks joining hands presaged the apocalypse. At the head of 500 men, Bacon burned down Jamestown, forcing Berkeley to flee. When Bacon died of dysentery in October, the rebellion was doomed. Luring whites with pardons and blacks with liberty, Berkeley's forces persuaded most of Bacon's army to lay down their weapons. They spent the next few years crushing the rest of the rebels. Rich planters learned from Bacon's rebellion that poor whites had to be forever separated from enslaved blacks. They divided and conquered by creating more white privileges. In 1680, legislators pardoned only the white rebels. They prescribed 30 lashes for any slave who lifted a hand against any Christian. Christian now meant white. All whites now wielded absolute power to abuse any African person. By the early 18th century, every Virginia county had a militia of landless whites ready in case of any sudden eruption of Indians or insurrection of Negroes. Poor whites had risen into their lowly place in slave society, the armed defenders of planters, a place that would sow bitter animosity between them and enslaved Africans. Cotton Mather was in college when he detached Metacomet's jaw from his skull and heard about Bacon's rebellion. Back in the summer of 1674, Increase Mather crossed the Charles River to present an 11-year-old Cotton Mather for admission as the youngest student in Harvard's history. He was already well known in New England as an intellectual prodigy, or, from the Puritan standpoint, the chosen one. Cotton Mather was fluent in Latin, running through 15 chapters of the Bible a day, and as pious as boys came. Smaller than a sixth-grade pupil, when Cotton Mather walked onto the tiny campus, he was like a self-righteous politician entering a corrupted Congress. The dozen or so 15 to 18-year-olds schemed to break the 11-year-old's moral backbone until Increase Mather complained about the hazing. The teenagers stopped prodding him to sin, but sin still bedeviled him. Sin was like the shadow he could never shake. The most trivial incident could explode into anxiety. One day, his tooth ached. Have I not sinned with my teeth? His mind raced. How? By sinful, graceless, excessive eating, and by evil speeches. Cotton Mather had started stuttering, and the incessant self-searching and the burden of trying to live up to his two famous names may have worsened his condition. For the young minister in training, the soul-searching setback caused him to turn to his ink and quill. Insecure in speech, Cotton Mather seemed to be a different person as a writer, confident, brilliant, and artistic. His father allowed him to write up many important church and government documents. Cotton ended up writing 7,000 pages of sermons in his notebooks between the ages of 13 and 32, far and away more sermonic pages than any other American Puritan. and his diary from 1681 to 1725 is the lengthiest available of any American Puritan. Cotton Mather had been encouraged all along by his anxious but reassuring father. Sooner or later, Cotton steeled his determination to find a way around the mighty rock. The youth incessantly practiced away his stammer by singing psalms and speaking slowly, and by the end of his Harvard days, he had learned to control it. He was delivered.